Hello everyone, this is Dark Journalist with a special interview for you with author and political researcher Whitney Webb. Whitney has just put out a remarkable two-volume set, One Nation Under Blackmail, walking through decades of national security state covert activity. From Roy Cohn to Jeffrey Epstein, the figures are familiar, but her wide-angle lens gets to the truth behind the story, whether it's the CIA, NSA, DHS, or organized crime. Take your pick. Please join us now. Khashoggi, just give me that capsule version of Khashoggi in the 80s. He is the preeminent arms dealer. He's got these yachts all over the world. He runs these sex blackmail rings.
Again, he's a very complex guy, best known as a Saudi Arabian arms dealer, but he has intelligence ties to all pretty much every intelligence agency under the sun. I mean, it's really crazy. So in the early 80s, he's on the payroll of Israeli intelligence. He's tied up with the CIA. He's tied up with all sorts of European intelligence, of course, Saudi intelligence, but you could convincingly argue that the Saudi intelligence apparatus has for a long time been very much under the thumb of the Anglo-American alliance, right? So you have Khashoggi more or less in that orbit. At the same time, he's involved in some sort of sex blackmail thing with that was being run in Europe. The madam of it was called Madam Tuna. Her real name was Fortuna Israel. And on his yacht, he had an alleged harem of women that he would use as quote unquote bait to manipulate the people that came on his yacht, which included prominent people from the private and public sector. We can assume that he used that leverage to benefit his arms business, but probably other things as well. And so what's interesting about Khashoggi, of course, in the 80s is that he's sort of setting into motion what becomes Iran-Contra in terms of that scandal. He's probably best known for sort of bridging the trust problem between the people that want to sell weapons to Iran's government and the Khomeini-led government of Iran by making a large payment to Iran on behalf of, I believe, Israeli intelligence. So what's interesting in that context is by the time that payment is made, the person, according to both Vicky Ward and Steve Hoffenberg, a former business partner of Epstein's, his basically Khashoggi's banker or a financial guy that he's hired for reasons we don't know, is Jeffrey Epstein. So Jeffrey Epstein leaves Bear Stearns in March 1981 under a cloud of scandal related to an SEC investigation about insider trading of the Bronfman family flagship company Seagram's. So 2 months before this, up until 2 months before then, so from before the time that Jeffrey Epstein joins Bear Stearns, which is I believe 76 or so, up until January 1981, the legal counsel for Bear Stearns is William Casey. And 2 months later, the SEC investigation gets too hot for Epstein, and he's advised to leave Bear Stearns, probably because the top guy at Bear Stearns, Alan Greenberg, is his mentor. And the person that saw his rapid ascendancy at the bank, or sort of oversaw that rapid ascendancy of Epstein's at the bank. So obviously any sort of incrimination of Epstein could have led to the downfall of Greenberg himself. So presumably we can assume, right, if you're CIA director Bill Casey, and even as CIA director, Bill Casey did not disentangle himself from his personal finances, like he didn't divest of all his business interests, even when he was CIA director. So you can probably assume that he would have left his legal clients in good hands of someone he trusted, right? Mm-hmm. So that person is the person that most likely advised Epstein to leave Bear Stearns. It's an interesting connection. Uh-huh. So you have Epstein after that enter this murky period of time that sort of lasts from, you know, when he leaves in March 1981 until roughly 1985 or so. His company is ostensibly called, I think, Intercontinental Assets Group, something like that. And basically what he's doing, and there's numerous attestations to this, including from Epstein himself, is that he was hiding or finding looted money for powerful people. So right from the he called himself a financial bounty hunter. So right from that, you should know that being able to engage in those types of activity involves, one, a willingness to break the law. If you're hiding looted money for powerful people, you're an accessory to financial crimes. And two, it means you have an intimate working knowledge of the offshore financial system and where financial criminals like to hide their money. So that's the backdrop to this connection between him and Khashoggi. Khashoggi's main bank during Iran-Contra and in this period of time in general is BCCI. Mm-hmm. So it's very likely that Epstein knew a lot about BCCI. And Hoffenberg, off the record, he's dead now, but off the record alleged to at least one journalist I know of that Epstein did work for BCCI, but that's just one source, right? But there is some other corroborating evidence for a relationship there.
It makes sense.
Yeah, totally. Well, BCCI was really a private intelligence apparatus more than a bank. And as I note in the book, it was heavily involved itself, the bank, in the sex trafficking of minors. And the operation that BCCI was running in that regard has very eerie similarities to what Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell would later do in Palm Beach. Right. Just very eerie similarities. So, and they were specifically trafficking minors to the elite of the United Arab Emirates and other unspecified VIPs of BCCI. Right. But basically, BCCI was very much involved in money laundering and as an accessory to financial crimes of all sorts, allegedly founded by Pakistani intelligence with the involvement from the CIA, specifically former CIA director Richard Helms, were the people really involved there. And then, of course, you have people like Clark Clifford and a lot of other prominent people in the U.S. political system or, you know, in the private sector involved in the entry of BCCI into the U.S. financial system and all sorts of crazy ongoings there. And you see Clark Clifford and some of these other BCCI people pop up with Epstein at this very suspect fundraiser at the Clinton White House in 1993, which ends up in Vince Foster's suicide note, oddly enough. But going back to Epstein and all of that, so you have Adnan Khashoggi and Epstein with this relationship with Iran-Contra. And at the same time, you have people who worked directly under Bill Casey in the Reagan campaign and who were close friends of his, Robert Keith Gray and Roy Cohn, also take on Khashoggi as a client in the same period of time. So it's just very odd when you consider that sort of Casey Bear Stearns connection, why this might be happening. And of course, Iran-Contra was really set into motion by, you know, Bill Casey decisions as well. And then Adnan Khashoggi was sort of a broker for getting that off the ground, at least the Middle East side of that. Iran-Contra, again, is really complex and has different components. So you have, you know, the Latin America to US side of things, the drug running, the Contra support apparatus itself. And then you have the arms for hostages stuff with Iran and the Iran-Iraq war. But it's basically what Bill Casey was essentially trying to do with Iran-Contra. And I think the biggest takeaway that people should have from that scandal, it's not just arms for hostages, whatever. It was basically about Bill Casey wanting to have no oversight of CIA activities ever. And so this necessitated that he never had to ask Congress or the government for money for black ops ever again. So it was a way to create a self-financing black budget, which it necessitated engaging in crimes and laundering the money. And this was the drug trafficking and the arms trafficking and all of that. And this is sort of the base of the enterprise. It's about the offshore financial system and financial criminality is a key component of this. And you really see it just take over everything else with Iran-Contra. And you have people like Jeffrey Epstein really in the center of that. And so what's interesting when you're looking at things like the Epstein-Clinton relationship is that you see, you know, after this period, Epstein gets involved with Leslie Wexner. We'll leave that, you know, to the side for now. But he gets involved with Stephen Hoffenberg. He masterminds one of the biggest Ponzi schemes in U.S. history at Towers Financial. In 1993, his name is dropped from the case. Even though he should go to jail, but instead of going to jail, he's just mysteriously dropped from the case. That obviously involves intervention from high levels. He's invited to the White House by Robert Rubin, then director of the National Economic Council. Before then was head of Goldman Sachs. Again, this is the bank that was a major accessory to Robert Maxwell's financial crimes, as it related to the theft of the Mirror pension funds and all of that. And so that, you know, the head of that is inviting Epstein to the White House. He's not going to prison for being a Ponzi schemer, but he's a financial criminal. His whole track record since leaving Bear Stearns is financial crime. Nice. Either with Khashoggi and intelligence related stuff or arms trafficking type stuff or with Towers Financial. And then, of course, the Leslie Wexner side of stuff, which is tied up with organized crime and all other sorts of crazy stuff, which we can get to later. But you have, I mean, it's just you have Robert Rubin, and then you have this fundraiser that's involving BCCI adjacent people like Clark Clifford and other shadow banking people like C. Gerald Goldsmith, who are very interesting. And I talk about them in the book as well. But they're involved with this fundraiser that's supposed to be about refurbishing the White House. It's a White House Historical Association fundraiser overseen by Hillary Clinton. And it's mentioned, it's the only mention of Hillary Clinton in Vince Foster's quote unquote suicide note. Then you have Epstein being involved with fundraising in the 1996 campaign, which again was heavily scrutinized and involved a lot of illegal activity, including Chinagate and this stuff. And you have Epstein doing basically 15 meetings with Mark Middleton in about a year or so. Just a lot of meetings. And Mark Middleton was the sort of central figure in that campaign finance scandal.
Right.
And then after that, you have Epstein being intimately involved in the creation of the Clinton Foundation, which is basically the Clinton Financial Slush Fund, and designing the Clinton Foundation's HIV/AIDS access initiatives and stuff.
So he's deep in with the Clintons in the 90s.
He's like a, if you see what I'm saying here with this timeline, he's a financial criminal. He gets involved with Clinton, the most controversial fundraisers of the Clinton presidential era, and then goes and sets up their slush fund after he's president, the Clinton Foundation. So this is a guy that's like a financial criminal that benefits powerful people. Yeah. He's not just a sex trafficker, and there's no focus on this side of the story from the mainstream media. Because, I mean, if they did, they'd have to admit the Clintons are crooks, and they'll never do that.
Yeah. Right? Yeah, that's a big problem for them. You, what you're doing with Epstein there is giving us also, I mean, they love to get into the whole sex part with Epstein because it's sort of, you know, the traditional thing that they can go to and look like, hey, we're covering this story. And they do that with Maxwell, too. What intrigues me about those two is their targeting of scientists. And this is what I think is a great unanswered question out there. And the fact that they were financial fixers and that you have them on the scene in the 90s with the financial fixing is fascinating. There's a whole thing that came out in the Virginia Giuffre testimony against Prince Andrew about them targeting Marvin Minsky.
Yeah, the AI pioneer. There's a lot of weird stuff there. So I think the Marvin Minsky stuff, to understand how that relationship may have happened, you have to look at something, a company that was a DARPA contractor trying to make a supercomputer in the 80s. It's called Thinking Machines. Marvin Minsky and a guy named Danny Hillis were basically running that. Uh-huh. And Danny Hillis is a very well-known, intimate Epstein associate. In a lot of the early reporting on Epstein, like The Fabulous Mr. Epstein by Vicki Ward and those reporting that those reports from like 2000, 2003, after there was sort of a brief media buzz about Epstein because Clinton was on his plane for the Africa stuff when he was setting up the Clinton Health Access Initiative. You had mentions of Danny Hillis there, right? So Danny Hillis is like a very well-known associate of Epstein, and Marvin Minsky is there with him at Thinking Machines. But another interesting figure is Eric Lander. Eric Lander is subsequently funded by Epstein, though Lander denies this, but I don't think Jeffrey Epstein was lying about funding him on his website well before he was infamous, and there's pictures of Epstein and Lander meeting together. Anyway, Eric Lander is best known probably for the Human Genome Project, and of course, most recently for being Biden's disgraced science advisor.
Right.
Yes. But before that, back in the 80s, he worked at Thinking Machines.
Interesting.
So it's interesting. You have a lot of people that just end up being around Epstein and they're all at Thinking Machines.
Okay.
And this sort of goes back to some of the stuff I want to look into at the future as it relates to some of the Iran-Contra involvement and this tech transfer stuff around Chinagate and the origins of Silicon Valley. You have a lot of weird stuff going on in supercomputer land, which I think is part of the mystery behind, for example, Epstein's activities on this Microsoft Russia trip with Nathan Myhrvold in the late 90s. That doesn't make a lot of sense why Epstein would be there and why he's taking pictures with this guy from this nuclear facility in Russia. Yeah, that particular facility in Russia had been in trouble because supercomputers from this company tied up with this broader ChinaGate nexus were like illegally selling them supercomputers. And so anyway, there's this weird theme of supercomputers and computing and software like throughout all of this that's just very bizarre. But Thinking Machines was one of these main companies trying to build the supercomputer. And they were getting a lot of their money from DARPA. And a lot of these guys that came out of that, including Minsky and Hillis, they're big promoters of transhumanism. And of course, Epstein himself was a very avid transhumanist, funding the World Transhumanist Association, now Humanity Plus. And of course, one of, I think their vice president, Ben Goertzel, was heavily funded by Epstein as well. And he runs Hanson Robotics, which, if you're familiar with, Sophia the Robot is produced by Hanson Robotics. Oh, yeah. And what's interesting, a lot of people don't make this connection, and unfortunately I had to end volume two pretty early on. Like, there's a lot of stuff I couldn't explore just because of space limitations. I mean, it's a 1,000-page book, so
they're both lengthy books. It's fantastic.
Yeah, but a lot of the science tech stuff I could only sort of dabble in. Mm-hmm. I couldn't delve deep into it just because of those limitations, right?
I can appreciate it.
But I'd like to in the future, because there's a lot there, I think, to chew on. But a lot of people haven't really bothered to talk about the close relationship between Epstein and Mohammed bin Salman of Saudi Arabia. Mm-hmm. So upon the raid of Epstein's house in 2019, numerous reports talked about the wealth of photographs of Epstein with MBS. Huh. That's a bit weird, especially when you consider the circumstances in which Mohammed bin Salman was brought into power, his closeness to people like Jared Kushner, Adam Neumann of WeWork, weird nexuses there, the connection with Trump, his friendliness towards Israel, among other things, and how he was allowed to depose basically a very close associate of John Brennan, the former CIA director, Mohammed bin Nayef, who was had a lot of seniority compared to Mohammed bin Salman because of age. Who had been crown prince up to that time, and Mohammed bin Salman's allowed to go and clean house and sort of, have that Ritz-Carlton, I don't even know what to call it, consolidation of power ritual, I don't know, where he basically like threatened to kill a bunch of his relatives in order to consolidate power, right?
It's like, so anyway,
you have Epstein being very close with this guy who seems to have been brought to power by unconventional forces, like, mm-hmm. in the Saudi Arabia power structure, because it's able to sort of uproot a guy who's very close to the CIA, basically, and place someone else there.
Right. Do you put anything in the fact that William Barr's father kind of got Epstein started?
Yeah, but I don't want to go. I just want to connect what I'm trying to show here.
Okay, well, hold on that. Mohammed bin Salman.
Mohammed bin Salman's the guy that, once he gets into power, starts talking about Vision 2030, sounds a lot like Agenda 2030, doesn't it? And starts talking about how we're going to do this post-oil economy, we're going to do all this digitalization of stuff, tech stuff, and he gives Sophia the Robot citizenship. And Sophia the Robot just happens to be an Epstein-funded scientist. I think Epstein was all over that. And Epstein was also the guy that was going to get Saudi Arabia to help take Tesla private for Elon Musk in 2018. That was Epstein. So there's some weird stuff going on there. And if you ask me, I think the reason Epstein was allowed to be taken down wasn't because of sex trafficking. It was because he pissed off John Brennan and that whole faction of people because of his association with MBS and the particular faction that brought MBS to power. I think it's a consequence of this factionalism between the power elite.
That's interesting.
Because John Brennan hates Trump and all that stuff, and that particular power nexus that saw MBS come up and was close to Trump, close to Kushner. Yeah, Epstein seemed to be particularly on that side, at least at the time of his arrest, affiliated with that.
Yeah. How do you read Epstein with Trump?
I don't think necessarily Trump and Epstein had to have a direct relationship in 2019 for them to sort of be in the more broader power faction, because Trump is just a face, right? You know, he has backers. His biggest backer was Sheldon Adelson, who's he's dead now, but he was the biggest donor in all of U.S. politics at the time of his death.
All right.
And basically, you know, financed the bulk of the Republican Party. And his big thing was to get Jerusalem recognized as the capital of Israel. And then he also installed John Bolton as national security advisor under Trump. So, you know, Trump conceded and did both of those big requests for Sheldon Adelson, maybe some other ones we don't really know about. But, you know, obviously, if you're going to be a presidential candidate of one of the two arms of the Uniparty in the United States, you have powerful backers. Does that mean you're friends with all of the powerful backers, other affiliates and friends? Not necessarily. As far as we know, Trump and Epstein parted ways in the early 2000s. And there's plenty of evidence for that. That doesn't necessarily mean that Trump is clean as it relates to Epstein, right? But, you know, in 2019, there's no evidence of them being necessarily closely associated, but I think they had the same sort of, you know, power behind them, which was, you know, pretty Zionist heavy.
There's a lot coming out seeming related to Musk and Ghislaine Maxwell.
So it's a little different than that, I would say. So there's the picture right in 2014 of Elon Musk and Ghislaine Maxwell. Beyond that, I haven't seen a lot as far as it goes to Musk.
There's
and
a Vanity
Maxwell.
Fair editor who said that they had a conversation about aliens, actually. So
oh, that's interesting. Photobomb. No, yeah. I hadn't seen that. So as I do write about Musk in the book in a couple of chapters.
Yeah.
Mainly as it relates to SpaceX. So right. SpaceX allegedly was toured, its facilities were toured by Epstein after Kimball Musk, Elon's brother, was set up with a member of Epstein's entourage after the woman dated Epstein for an unspecified number of years.
Interesting.
And then Epstein gets in and is taking tours and whatever, and then later becomes an advisor to Tesla. But won't publicly be an advisor to Tesla because, in Epstein's own words, at that point in time, he's radioactive. But there's, you know, and I talk about sort of Epstein's real estate investments in the real estate company tied up with his brother, Mark Epstein, and the intersections of that network with a lot of the contractors for SpaceX.
Interesting.
So there's some weird business connections there for sure. Uh-huh. Yeah. Mm-hmm. With SpaceX now, one of the top investors in there is NJF Capital, which is the venture capital arm of Nicole Yunkerman, who's a very intimate Epstein associate who I talk about extensively in volume 2 of the book, because there's a lot of evidence that she was involved with the sexual blackmail of two sitting U.S. senators in 2002 by Epstein at a Wexner residence in the United Kingdom. And when we tried to get a Freedom of Information Act request about the identity of the senators that were in the UK at the time, we were hit with no, we can't give you that information for national security reasons by the Met Police. So she's since become an investor, but she was popping up alongside a bunch of very suspicious companies, including some that were funded by Epstein, like Carbine 911, which was essentially created by a very close Epstein associate and former prime minister of Israel, Ehud Barak. She was a director there and has a very interesting history with Epstein. And I was on the flight logs numerous times, in addition to, you know, the incident, we'll call it, in the United Kingdom. Very so she has now heavily invested in SpaceX.
What do you think they're doing with Musk?
So right now, I think it's a PR thing to get you to trust at least one of the billionaires that's going to sell you your own slavery. Mm-hmm. Because as I mentioned earlier, the WEF, a lot of these organizations that have very bad PR right now, want you to trust them. And they've had a lot of policy papers out about rebuilding trust, and they need people to trust the media. Trust in the media is lower than ever before. So if you're the establishment, you have to create a good guy that people trust that will sell them the same shit.
Right.
Right. So a lot of people are like, well, Elon Musk is good now. Because look what he's doing with Twitter. His brain chip won't be bad, like Jeff Bezos's brain chip or ex-billionaire X's brain chip or whoever the competitor will be. You know, they'll want
it's a large
brand
scale,
Elon.
Right. Large-scale PR exercises.
Yeah, it looks like that to me. I mean, also, I think at one level, I think Elon Musk likes the attention.
Yeah. But I mean, one guy with all these companies, you know, we have the Twitter thing. Yes. But SpaceX, boring, Tesla. I mean, it's kind
of. Well, SpaceX is a military contractor. It's also an intelligence contractor.
Yeah.
And it was completely dependent on the state for its success because it's not profitable.
Right.
And the same is true with Tesla. And a lot of these companies would not exist unless he was, he was given heavily subsidized by the U.S. taxpayer loans to build his businesses. And that doesn't happen like unless creating you're
a space president.
Yeah, well, there was this whole idea that he's going to be, what, president of Mars?
Right.
Or something. Yeah, no thanks.
interesting. I agree with you. The dynamics around him and the way that he's portrayed and how they did this whole thing with him taking over Twitter.
He wants to turn Twitter into WeChat. He said it. He wants to make it the everything app.
Right.
Think about, I'm sure a lot of people have heard data is the new oil, right? So who is the oligarch of the oil economy? It's the Rockefellers. It was Standard Oil. They own the oil, and that's what the economy ran on was oil. If data is the new oil and the economy runs on data, if you control the everything app, you control all the data, don't you?
Yes.
Because more people are using your app for everything else, and you're producing more data from the app that you own than all other apps because it's the everything app. People are using it for everything because they're essentially compelled to, right?
Yes.
So
that'll definitely become some kind of biometric interface app. That's where they're going with it.
Yeah, or, they'll tie it to the brain chip. Wouldn't that be convenient for Elon?
The dangers involved with that.
There's just inherent dangers in trusting billionaires, and people would be wise to remember that.
Give me the digital slavery piece that they're creating with this. Basically, with the biometric ID, with the brain chips and the rest of it, the idea of dissidents or free speech and all that stuff just disappears, and you're just part of this machine. You're part of the Internet of Things. Where do you see things going with the efforts on behalf of these forces that are bringing in the transhumanism and on a governmental level requiring people become sort of a biometric interface with their system? Okay,
so there's a couple different aspects. So the transhumanist stuff is being sold as augmentation, but that's not what it is. So if you look at the ideological antecedents of this, it's about splitting humanity into two groups. It's basically neo-feudalism, but created by tech. So you have two classes of humans. You have the subservient workers who, are... as the described by the eugenicist and also science fiction writer H.G. Wells 100 years ago, he said humanity was going to split into two. There would be the servile, goblin-like working class that would eat bugs, right? And then there would be the elite, intelligent, tall, attractive elite class. And that's essentially where this is going. It's not there to augment everyone. To say the very least, they don't. That's if you look into the nuts and bolts of this, that's not what the plan is, right?
They want to take that piece of humanity and use it on them and give them the benefits of it, basically.
I think yes, that's essentially. And I wish I had more time to sort of flesh out all of that, but essentially, it's a lie that it's going to be used to augment everyone.
Okay.
I also think they lie about how advanced this technology is. I don't think they're actually going to achieve the singularity because they already would have. I think they're probably going to fake it at some point and then say we have this superior intelligence and we should do whatever it says. And that can be used to give them basically a blank check to justify whatever policy they want or implement whatever policy they want and then be like, well, AI is too intelligent to explain itself. So... we can't justify why it made this decision. And if you listen to people like Eric Schmidt, who just co-wrote a book with Henry Kissinger about AI and governance, that's essentially what they say AI and governance will be like. So if you're a criminal like Henry Kissinger in government and you want to justify the mass murder of people, AI says it, and then it's not your fault.
Fascinating.
So I think they're going to fake it. But in digital ID, we sort of already talked about, it's sort of a centerpiece for everything you'll be allowed to do. And they plan to tie literally every aspect of your life to it. And what we just mentioned with the Everything app will be sort of the interface between through which you interact with the world through your digital identity. But it's all about surveillance and data mining and this whole pre-crime system with domestic terror we talked about earlier, that's sort of, you know, gone from promise to now Palantir, which is basically a CIA front company. They're going to be, you know, profiling you. And if, you know, instead of doing it like they did it with the Phoenix program and Condor and all of that stuff, it's a pre-crime system now. So it's not necessarily let's round everyone up. It's like you say the wrong thing and then, you know, pre-crime comes at you.
It triggers the alarm.
It's evolved over the years, but the end goal is the same.
Fantastic. Great. incredible. It's great to meet you. And your work is remarkable.
Likewise. Thank you.
I'm hoping that there's something you're going to tell us next time about why they're talking about UFOs all the time now, when they used to be completely tight-lipped about it, and why those agencies now, DIA, CIA, all want to push the UFO thing. That I want to hear.
Yeah, it's interesting. Well, I guess, you know, if they're trying to, I think they're just going to try and throw everything at us and see what sticks. You know what I mean?
Excellent point. Yeah, fantastic. The book is One Nation Under Blackmail,
volumes 1 and 2. You can get the physical copies as a bundle for cheaper, direct from the publisher. Don't buy from Amazon if you can avoid it. TRINEday.com. And there you can find a bundle, but there's also an ebook and there's an upcoming audiobook that'll be out early next year.
Oh, that's fantastic. Are you doing the audiobook?
No. But someone else is.
Okay.
And they sound nice. So,
excellent. You know. That's always something off your schedule there. It's great to meet you. I hope things are going great in Chile. And
it's summer, so they're going all right. At least they don't have to chop wood and, you know, do all that stuff.
Great. The book's gotten a fantastic reaction. It seems to me that people are picking up on what you're bringing forward with the book. So that's always good too.
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, really, I just hope it generates a discussion about, you know, how far gone things really are and what we do about it. Because, you know, people, I think, need to realize that there's no saving the system. It's all about building a parallel system before we're sucked into the slavery system that this is becoming. But it's important to understand how we got here. And, you know, I'm hoping that my book can help, you know, connect some dots for some people.
And Whitney, they find you at unlimitedhangout.com.
Yes, my website is unlimitedhangout.com. So even stuff I publish in other sites, like I occasionally write for The Last American Vagabond and some other websites, it all eventually gets republished on my site. I also have a newsletter you can sign up for to get information about, you know, all the interviews I do, my podcast, which is also called Unlimited Hangout. And of course, articles that are published, not just by myself, but other people that contribute to Unlimited Hangout, like Matt Arrett, Johnny Vedmore, John Klezak, hopefully Corey Morningstar soon. That would be lovely. But, you know, we have other people besides myself, of course, that write there. So I'd encourage your viewers to check it out.
Outstanding. Great information. All right. I've kept you long enough. Have a great afternoon over there.
Thank you.
All right. We'll talk soon. And that was Whitney Webb, the author of One Nation Under Blackmail, and just an incredible 2-volume set going very deep on the national security state and how it came to be and what we're looking at, really. I think one of the great questions that we raised in the interview is this whole aspect of the dawn of Elon Musk as the savior of social media, and how we need to really look at the nature of that background with Musk and those 70, 80 years of history that we've had working with this deep state apparatus going into all these different areas. We will be back with you next Friday, and we'll have a new edition of the X series for you, along with some special reports and more interviews coming up, to stay in touch and let you know the remarkable shows that we have coming up for you in 2023. See you soon.